break here, but we're going to continue with part two of our discussion posted at WebEx at democracynow.org. Aram Rostam, journalist, BuzzFeed News, will link to his piece on American mercenaries hired to assassinate politicians in the Middle East. That does it for our show. I'll be speaking in Gainesville, Florida on Friday, in Melbourne on Saturday. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And you're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meetings policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Finance Committee meets the fourth Monday of every month at 4:30 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the screening of Queer Core, How to Punk a Revolution, on Sunday, October 21st at 7:30 at the Hollywood Theater in Portland. Queer Core, How to Punk a Revolution gives one answer to the question, what happens when the community you need is not the community you have? Queer Core shows the development of the movement through the rise of artists who used radical queer identity to push back equally against gay assimilation and homophobic culture. The film features Bruce LaBruce, G.B. Jones, John Waters, Tom Jennings, Team Dresch, and many more. Again, that's the screening of Queer Core, How to Punk a Revolution, on Sunday, October 21st, 7:30, at the Hollywood Theater, 4122 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
It's a little past five, and KBOO Evening News is coming up next. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Hopworks Urban Brewery, offering sustainable brews and local food for 10 years, serving the community at three locations: Hopworks Urban Brewery on Southeast Powell Boulevard, Bike Bar at North Williams Avenue, and in Vancouver on Southeast Mill Plain Boulevard. More information online at hopworksbeer.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, recreational marijuana is now legal along the West Coast from the Mexican border all the way through Canada.
The Coalition of Communities of Color hosted an election forum in Southwest Portland this morning.
And in international news, we'll hear updates on recent actions taken against Palestinian protesters by the Israeli military.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, October 17th, 2018. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Aaron J. Bernard. FBI Special Counsel Robert Mueller will not be releasing findings in the Russia probe ahead of the midterm elections on November 6th. That's according to the Washington Post, quoting two unnamed U.S. officials, who also said that Mueller will probably issue findings on two of the central subjects of the probe soon after the elections. Those two subjects of investigation are whether there were, quote, clear incidents of collusion between Trump's campaign and Russia, and whether the president did anything that constitutes obstruction of justice. Whether or not those findings will be released to the public is another matter. Mueller's immediate supervisor is Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein. The conditions under which the probe began say that Mueller himself can only present the findings to Rosenstein, who may himself be fired and replaced by the president after the midterms. Mueller has been under increasing pressure from the executive branch to either secure more indictments and guilty pleas or else end the investigation. The probe has already netted 20 indictments and guilty pleas. Neither the unnamed officials or Mueller's office indicated to the Post what the conclusions of Mueller's findings might be.
The Coalition of Communities of Color held an election forum today at the Sentinel Hotel. KBOO's Sam Bowman was there and has this report.
30 this morning, several dozen people attended an election forum at the Sentinel Hotel in Southwest Portland. The forum was put on by the Coalition of Communities of Color and moderated by their advocacy director, Jenny Lee. She asked questions of Street Roots managing editor Joanne Zuhl and Carlos Covarrubias with El Hispanic News. The forum was pitched as an opportunity to hear about the many ballot measures on this year's ballot from journalists representing marginalized communities. Two topics that ran through the whole discussion were changes in voter turnout and the involvement of out-of-state interests in Oregon politics. The forum was also a counterpoint to another forum, also held today in the Sentinel Hotel, but hosted by the Portland Business Association. The unrepresentative and inaccessible nature of the PBA was a topic that came up later in the forum. Here, Covarrubias details their pricing structure for membership.
Nonprofit membership dues, $345 annually. The solo entrepreneurs, $480 annually. Small business, $885. It didn't really give parameters as to what, you know, how they were defining each of these, but it just kind of grows and grows and grows. You know, the director membership, $2,870. Medallion membership, whatever that means, $16,565. The highest membership level is the trustee level of $52,390. Now that just seems, that seems like a lot of money. And I, you know, kind of looking at their, their organizational chart, it seemed very reflective of, you know, who's paying the most money to be involved in this. Looks essentially just an obvious group.
Street Roots' Joanne Zuhl explained the problem with a small percentage of business interests, and especially national and even global companies, putting so much of their money into Oregon politics.
I guess it's just this ongoing political extension of globalism where, you know, what Oregonians have to say and how we want to be governed and how we want our money used and the people we want to take care of and how we want to see our future and protect our hills and our children is being decided by federal organizations, corporations, global corporations, with interests that have not, I don't think, is taking care of Oregon or any of our citizens.
On the subject of voter turnout, Zuhl reminded attendees that Portland is a blue island in a red state, and there is much on the ballot to energize voters across the political spectrum. Aside from the right-wing-driven measures to repeal the sanctuary law and restrict abortion access, there are also measures like 102, a funding measure for affordable housing statewide, that have surprisingly broad support. Here, Zuhl references a recent Street Roots series on the statewide housing shortage.
We're a little island in a big state that has a lot of red in it, so there's a lot of, you know, different issues. We did a rural housing project recently. We're actually still working on it. To look at rural issues, rural housing issues, and concerns in these smaller communities, recognizing that they're far different from a place like Portland that has a lot of resources, that has more diversity than, say, compared to Burns, that we have a different perspective here and there are, in the communities that we swim in, than a lot of these rural communities where they're really struggling, where they don't have these resources, they don't have these options and these choices, and I think that's where a whole different viewpoint comes from.
Covarrubias gave his perspective on Latinx voter turnout, galvanized not just by Measure 105, but also by generational and demographic factors.
Carlos, how are things looking on your end?
You know, I feel that there's a kind of resurgence in activism and kind of the younger Latino community, even within those communities that aren't documented. DACA recipients have been particularly vocal in the last few years, just about getting involved, about, you know, trying to support their peers who can vote, who, you know, to vote and to generally kind of what we refer to in the Hispanic community as wake the sleeping giant. You know, there's kind of this, it's been known for a long time that the Hispanic community is a large community in the United States overall, and there's a large voter base there. However, you know, I think because there's kind of a lot of idea, there's kind of this consensus among usually first generation immigrants who kind of have this idea that maybe they'll just come to the United States and go back to Mexico or Central America and kind of, you know, bring whatever wealth they've accumulated back to those parts of the world that they don't want to engage in politics here, but their children, the younger generations realize that this is home, and so that they really need to fight their battles here and not, kind of have this idea of, this kind of grand idea that, everything is just going to return to normal and they're going to go back to the old country, because that's just not how it works anymore. People, our younger generations want to stay here, they want to engage, they want to make space for themselves. And so I think, there's an anticipate, a good turnout from the younger Latino voters this election cycle.
Exciting to hear.
The Portland Clean Energy Initiative occupied the last section of the forum. This is a measure on the ballot opposed by many business interests, which taxes large corporations based on their environmental impact to fund job training for marginalized communities in the city. Here's Covarrubias.
No, I mean, I like the initiative both on a micro scale and on a macro scale. I think that, as I said before, it's very important for local municipalities to be able to take control of of what's going on in their communities. This is a Portland initiative. This isn't a statewide initiative. It's just Portland, and I think it is reflective of the values that Portland has, encompassed over the years of, inclusivity and also of, green values and trying to create, a future for our children, essentially. People of color historically have not always had access to clean energy jobs, and I like the idea of this grant fund being created to provide training and also just awareness of the impact of climate change on communities of color, low-income communities, because I think that is where the future is, and I think that is where the future of essentially the world is. And so to make sure that we are channeling communities of color, vulnerable communities, into a growing industry like green energy is absolutely the smart thing to do.
Tune in to the KBOO Evening News tomorrow night at 5:45 for an in-depth live interview about the Clean Energy Initiative with some of the measure's backers. For KBOO Evening News, I'm Sam Bowman.
As 15 water protectors and media in two boats observed construction on the Bayou Bridge pipeline in Louisiana, an Energy Transfer Partners security boat passed them at a high speed, creating a wake that swamped and sank the two smaller boats. While people could have drowned, they all managed to swim to shore with assistance from a local fisherman. A recently passed Louisiana law places harsh penalties for protesting at places considered to be in the, quote, public interest, which this pipeline is. Energy Transfer Partners had previously hired mercenaries to attack water protectors at Standing Rock.
An earthquake is coming to Portland tomorrow. But not to worry, this earthquake is only simulated. Regular Elementary School, in partnership with the Portland Bureau of Emergency Management, are participating in the nation's largest earthquake drill called the Great Shakeout. The Great Shakeout will involve not only our local community, but communities all across the United States. Along with multiple states and universities as partners, the United States Geological Survey will be developing and testing Shake Alert, an earthquake early warning system which, if successful and implemented, would be the first earthquake early warning system in use.
Early this morning in Springfield, a 60-year-old man set fire to a house and, when the fire truck showed up, began shooting at it. The firefighters called for police, who were also shot at. As more police reached the scene, the shooter/arsonist shot and killed himself. Because of the gunfire, firefighters were unable to take action, and the fire quickly spread to three other houses, with a total of three destroyed. Police haven't yet released the name of the man, who is believed to live in the area, but it's not certain yet if he lived in one of the burned houses.
Texas is now requiring students to watch a constructive video on how to talk to police, or else they cannot graduate from Texas schools. This instructional video and a training course is required for all students. It's 16 minutes long and was produced by Community Safety Education Acts. It starts off with dramatic music and cop lights flashing. It then switches to two girls driving, with one encouraging the other to speed and then getting pulled over. It then proceeds to display several different scenarios of different people being pulled over, showing how to properly act in each situation. The video makes clear it's expected that police and people should both know how to properly and safely respond and react during traffic stops. The video also switches to people asking questions they have for police officers and having them respond. Senator Royce West, a Dallas Democrat who authored the new legislation, explains the goals of the video, and the act is to define behavior expectations of citizens and officers during traffic stops. He says this content is designed to make certain that the trust factor between law enforcement and citizens is stronger than ever. It's a citizen's right to the videotape, the guide states. Drivers and passengers should be aware that unknown items in a citizen's hand may cause safety concerns for officers. The curriculum, which includes the video and guiding questions, is broken into four sections: the role of law enforcement, citizens' rights, proper behavior, and filing a complaint.
In Georgia, 40 black senior citizens were forced to get off a bus which was taking them to vote. Jefferson County officials said political activities are not permitted at government facilities like the senior center where the would-be voters were. The bus trip was organized by Black Votes Matter, a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization. The county clerk considered the event political because the county Democratic Party chairwoman, who did not attend the event, helped organize it. Georgia Attorney General Kemp, who is running for governor against Stacey Abrams, has purged over 50,000 mostly black voters from the registration rolls.
Now it's time for the daily national newscast from the Pacific News Service. The public news service has bureaus in 36 states dedicated to news in the public interest.
The Public News Service daily newscast for Wednesday, October the 17th, 2018. I'm Mike Clifford. CNN reveals an alleged Saudi connection to the killing of a Washington Post columnist. Also on the Wednesday rundown, early voting starts today in some states. Poverty rates remain steady, but many in New Jersey still are in need. And cautious praise for the Fed's proposal on drug ads. Topping our news, CNN reports a Saudi mission to interrogate and possibly abduct journalist Jamal Khashoggi in Istanbul was organized by a high-ranking officer with the General Intelligence Presidency, which is Saudi Arabia's main intelligence service. CNN attributes the story to three sources familiar with the case. One of those sources describes the officer involved as close to the inner circle of Crown Prince MBS. It's unclear whether the Crown Prince authorized an interrogation or abduction. CNN has previously reported that there were several U.S. officials that have said any such operation could not have happened without the prince's direct knowledge. Today, early voting precincts are open for people to cast their ballots in advance of the November election in North Carolina.
With constitutional amendments, U.S. House, state, and local seats all up for grabs, interest is high in North Carolina, and people are being urged to take advantage of the early voting opportunity. Tomas Lopez with Democracy NC says there's one more reason to consider voting early.
In case there's any kind of issue at all with your registration, it's a great idea to go during early voting, get it taken care of. You can also possibly help avoid some of the lines that we sometimes see on Election Day.
Unlike some neighboring states, early voting precincts in North Carolina offer one-stop voting, where people can register and vote at the same time. You are not required to present a photo ID when voting, but may need to show proof of address, such as a utility bill, if it's your first time voting in the precinct. Early voting runs until November 3rd. This is Stephanie Carson reporting.
North Carolina lawmakers passed a law this year mandating that all early voting sites in the state maintain the same hours, which is making early voting more expensive in some cases. The poverty rate didn't move much between 2016 and 2017, but Eric Tegenhoff tells us many folks in New Jersey are still struggling.
On this International Day for the Eradication of Poverty, the latest New Jersey poverty snapshot finds more than 880,000, or 10% of people in the state, lived in poverty in 2017. Renee Kubiatis, who has the Anti-Poverty Network of New Jersey, says housing costs are a big burden. According to the report, the majority of people making less than $35,000 a year spend more than half of their wages on rent.
We are a high-cost state, so it makes it even harder for people who are living with incomes that are too low to get by and to meet just basic needs for themselves, for their families.
The report finds communities of color are hit hardest, with about 18% of African Americans and more than 17% of Latinos in New Jersey living in poverty, compared to only 6% of whites. And children are the age group most likely to be living in poverty, at a rate of 13%. Deborah Weinstein, executive director of the Coalition on Human Needs, says the data her coalition is collecting shows continued pockets of poverty and extreme poverty, despite national averages that say the nation's poverty level has improved.
We know that in a growing economy, we should expect a lot of progress. We're getting some progress, but the rate of progress is slowing, and that's leaving a lot of people still struggling to make ends meet.
The top three worries of Minnesota kids and their parents as they head to school each morning are bullying, a possible school shooting, and pressure to do things they don't want to.
The list of top concerns is part of a survey by YouGov and shows kids between ages 6 and 17 now have greater concerns about a school shooting than the classic anxiety of fitting in. Barty Wahi with Children's Defense Fund Minnesota says the findings suggest the recent wave of shootings has cemented mass violence as an everyday concern among families.
35% of children and 35% of parents in the 12 states that made up the Midwest worry about shootings happening in school, which was really consistent with the national trend and the data we got across the country.
The survey included 5,500 children and parents.
And finally, consumer groups are praising a proposal by the Trump administration to require drug companies to put prices in many of their TV ads. But Suzanne Potter reports some worry it's only a pre-election perk designed to attract voters, one that could be dropped after the midterms.
The rule announced by federal health regulators would apply to drugs offered through Medicare or Medicaid that cost more than $35 per month or for a course of treatment. Frederick Isasi with the nonprofit Families USA says if finalized, the rule could show people the real cost of some well-known prescription drugs.
This is an important step forward because it gives consumers a sense of the magnitude of the drug. Is this a drug that's going to cost them $30 a month, $300 a month, $3,000 a month, $30,000 or more? Helping the American public understand the exorbitant prices being charged by drug companies.
The plan is opposed by the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, a trade group that proposed instead to put up a website in the spring that lists drug prices and copayments. Isasi says he'd like to see the administration actually negotiate lower prices for consumers.
One health research group says the U.S. spent $450 billion on prescription drugs in 2016 before rebates. If the administration finalizes the rule, pharmaceutical trade groups say they won't rule out litigation. I'm Mike Clifford. You've been newsin' and cruisin' with Public News Service. We are member and listener supported, and we are online at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for News from the Boo. Oh, excuse me, we're not going to have News from the Boo today. Actually, we're going to listen to News from the Boo's off this week. We're going to have a piece from Making Contact, an online media site that focuses on grassroots solutions to critical social issues. At 6, it's Say It Out Loud. At 6:30, it's Free Culture Radio. Then at 7, we have Combined Culture Radio. Tonight's weather will start clear with patchy fog later and a low of 49. Tomorrow will start with fog, becoming sunny with a high of 72. Today in history, 50 years ago, Olympic gold medalist Tommy Smith and bronze medalist John Carlos were forced to return their awards because they raised their fists in a Black Power salute during the medal ceremony. Quote of the day is from John Carlos. How can you ask someone to live in the world and not have something to say about injustice?
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael has a new and terrible muse, Mitch McConnell.
Mitch McConnell gave our tax money to the military that's bigger than all the other countries' militaries combined, and to the 1% of the 1% who already have more money than they know what to do with. Maybe spend $1.4 million on a piece of art that shreds itself? So the deficit's rising, and Mitch says we can't pay for the poor, old, and disabled to see their doctors, or for anyone to get back the money they put into Social Security to pay for food and life, because Mitch and his friends don't want Wall Street to collapse their mathematically imagined wealth and make those who own all the houses and apartments raise the rent so no one can afford to live there. Then where will we be? when one bubble after another bursts and we're neither the people with most of the money nor those with most of the guns, we're just most of the people. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
Black History 365 celebrates Black achievements and honors moments in Black history for each day of the year. Here comes today's episode.
Black history is happening every day. It's time to start thinking of it outside of a day or a week or a month. We hope to inspire you by enlightening you with those people and events that should be learned from and forever remembered.
Today is October 17th. On this day in 1956, the first African-American woman to travel into space, Dr. May Carol Jemison, was born in Decatur, Alabama. She became the first African-American woman to travel in space when she went into orbit aboard the Space Shuttle Endeavour on September 12, 1992.
Achievements and events are not confined to the past. Make sure to etch your own path in the pantheon of human history. This has been Black History Month 365, BAM 365, where you find every day Black history is made.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Megan Kamrick in for Antonia Gonzalez. Alaska Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott abruptly resigned Tuesday after allegations of inappropriate comments to an unidentified woman. Officials did not elaborate on what the comments were, but in his resignation letter, Mallott said he placed a person he respects in a position of vulnerability. Governor Bill Walker says the resignation is the right thing to do.
It's very, very disappointing in all respects, but it is. So I did want you to be aware this was not something of long ago. This was of, you know, I heard about it, you know, about 24 hours ago, and we took action right away.
Mallott is Walker's running mate on the independent ticket in a tight reelection bid. Walker says it's too late to remove Mallott's name from the ballot. Walker appointed Alaska Department of Health and Social Services Commissioner Valerie Davidson to fill Mallott's post. Mallott is Tlingit. His resignation is a possible blow for Native voters who historically have low turnout. Walker told National Native News anchor Antonio Gonzalez Native voter turnout is critical, but he says that's not the primary consideration in this instance.
Well, what took place today really had nothing to do with votes or elections. It had to do with the right thing to do. Our focus is, as I told the cabinet in an emergency cabinet meeting today, is, you know, it's not, our focus is not on how long we're going to be here, it's what we do while we're here.
The top internal watchdog for the U.S. Department of Interior is being replaced with a political appointee from the Department of Housing and Urban Development. The Washington Post reported Deputy Inspector General Mary Kendall, who has led the office for 9 years, is being replaced by Suzanne Israel Tufts, Assistant Secretary of HUD. Kendall was leading several investigations into Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke, including issues about travel by his wife and a land development deal in Montana. Government ethics watchdogs are concerned. The Inspector General audits and investigates waste, fraud, and abuse at 10 agencies. It's considered a nonpartisan position. Tufts has no background in government investigations or in environmental regulations. The announcement came in an email from HUD Secretary Ben Carson and took the Inspector General's office by surprise. A spokesman for Interior referred questions about who hired Tufts to the White House, which did not respond to a request for comment. Yakima Nation's KYNR radio studio in Washington State is working to get back on air after a devastating burglary last week. Thieves pushed in a window air conditioner to gain access and took some $20,000 worth of equipment. The station has been off the air since. Roy Dick, the Morning Man DJ, says staff is working on purchasing and installing new equipment thanks to an emergency financial boost from the Yakima Nation.
The Tribal Council, they want us to get back on the air ASAP, so they allocated some funds to get us back on air. And we just hurry up and wait now.
Dick says the equipment is insured. The items stolen include the broadcast console and electronics that would be difficult to sell secondhand.
Everything was gone. Control board, microphones, headphones, and the CD players, and the EAS system.
The EAS is the Emergency Alert System, which is a requirement for broadcast by the FCC. The 17-year-old tribal radio station airs a variety of Native programming, including National Native News. Dick says as news of the theft emerged, the station received numerous offers of support and sympathy.
A lot of callers have been calling in, dedicated listeners, and other radio stations, when they found out, they called to see what they can do to help us, and oh, it's heartbroken.
Tribal police are investigating. They say they've notified local pawn shops in case suspicious items show up there. For National Native News, I'm Megan Kamrick.
Recreational marijuana is now legal on the entire West Coast, from the Mexican border to the North Pole, with Canada becoming the second nation in the world to legalize the herb. In Newfoundland and Labrador, Canada's easternmost province, over 100 people braved the cold and wind in the capital, St. John's, to buy the country's first legal marijuana at midnight. Since many provincial governments only approved a small number of shops so far, and there's a shortage of pot, many Canadians will likely be celebrating legalization with black market pot. The federal government in many provinces have been cautious, starting with limited stores and products, including no edible pot for a year and tight supply control. The province of Ontario, containing Canada's largest city, Toronto, will have no outlets until April 2019, while the city of Vancouver in British Columbia has only one shop. Consumers can buy legal marijuana online from provincial governments or licensed retailers, although delivery will take a few days.
On Sunday, dozens of local peace groups gathered in Multnomah Village to protest a talk by Ehud Barak, the former Israeli Prime Minister and Defense Minister. The protesters say he was directly responsible for the massacre of civilians in Operation Cast Lead in 2009 and the vast expansion of illegal settlements in occupied Palestine. Last week, KABU intern Layla Kanan spoke with Mohammed Nabil, a Palestinian activist and KABU programmer, about the reasons for the protest and the effect of the Operation Cast Lead on the people of the Gaza Strip. Nabil was in Gaza during the opening days of that campaign.
Most of the people in Gaza have somebody who got injured, have somebody who got killed, have their houses being partially or completely demolished. All of the businesses have been affected, and also not even the animals have been spared from that type of obliteration, basically. And here in Portland, we are not just protesting Ehud because he's the bad guy or the only bad guy in Israel. Frankly, we are protesting him because he's a representation of the state of Israel policies against the Palestinian people, not just in Gaza, but also in the West Bank and inside Israel. The Palestinian people who live in Israel, there's 20% of the Palestinian people live in Israel right now. And also the Israeli state against the Palestinian people in the diaspora and preventing them from entering their homeland and visiting their people and their homes. So this is a protest. This is a sign to say, like, war criminals are not welcomed here, and we are here to say no and raise our voices.
Ehud Barak was hosted in Portland by the Jewish Federation as part of their year-long celebration of the 70th anniversary of the creation of the State of Israel. Israel was created in 1948 on land that had previously belonged to Palestine, displacing hundreds of thousands of Palestinians, many of whom remained displaced in refugee camps three generations later.
In the Gaza Strip this weekend, seven Palestinians were killed in protests at the border of Gaza and Israel. They were demanding that the siege on Gaza be lifted and that refugees be allowed their right to return to their homes. Although Israeli leaders claim that protesters placed an incendiary device at the border fence, Palestinians challenged that claim, saying that it was the force of the crowd that broke through the fence. Israeli forces opened fire on the crowd, killing seven and wounding nearly 200 with live ammunition. In the West Bank, meanwhile, at the site of a protest camp to protect the Palestinian village of Khan al-Ahmar from being demolished, Israeli bulldozers arrived on site this morning. Khan al-Ahmar has become a flashpoint for the issue of Israeli demolition of Palestinian homes since the Israeli authorities approved the destruction of the entire village 3 weeks ago. Protesters have remained on the site to try to stop the bulldozers with their bodies. This morning, the International Criminal Court's chief prosecutor, Fatou Bensoudou, issued a statement reminding Israel that demolishing Khan al-Ahmar would constitute a war crime. She also said that she would, quote, keep a close eye on Gaza.
And now it's time for the Middle East Minute Plus.
I'm Esti Chandler for the Middle East Minute Plus. As President Trump clumsily denies defending Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman while furthering public denials as to his role in the murder of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi, who entered but never left alive the Saudi consulate in Istanbul 2 weeks ago, Yemeni President Abid Rabu Mansour Hadi seems to be furthering the will of bin Salman in Yemen. Saba News Agency reports that Hadi has fired Prime Minister Ahmed bin Dagher, accusing him of negligence in running the country and ordering an investigation of his role in the country's economic crisis. Since 2015, when the Saudi-led coalition reinstated the UN-backed President Hadi and began bombing Yemen's Houthi rebels, the Yemeni rial has lost more than two-thirds of its value against the dollar. Last month, several Yemeni cities witnessed demonstrations over the high cost of living. The ousted bin Dagher has been at odds with southern Yemeni separatists and their main backer, the United Arab Emirates, a member of the Saudi-led coalition. In recent months, the UAE has been found to be backing the Southern Transitional Council in an effort to split Yemen into two countries, north and south, seemingly contrary to the objectives of the coalition. Ma'in Abdul Malik Said, the former Minister of Public Works and Roads, will replace bin Dagher. Yemeni political sources report that Said is known to have excellent relations with Saudi Arabia and the UAE. Yemen, one of the poorest Arab nations, has suffered greatly since the start of the Saudi-led and U.S.-backed war in 2015. Three-quarters of its population, some 22 million people, require aid, with 13 million reportedly on the brink of starvation. Nearly 10,000 people have been killed and more than 56,000 injured, with the UN deeming it one of the world's worst humanitarian crises today. This has been the Middle East Minute Plus, a joint project of KPFK and Jewish Voice for Peace.
Chilean fishery union leader Alejandro Castro was found hanging and dead on Monday, but those close to him say it was not suicide. The day before, Castro had successfully staged a mass mobilization against acute chemical pollution in the Puchuncavi-Quintero region, known as one of Chile's four sacrifice zones. Castro had received death threats and is now the third Chilean environmental activist to be killed in the last 5 years. Worldwide, the number of environmentalists killed is up from one a week 10 years ago to four a week at the present.
The Trump administration has increased the deportation of undocumented immigrants back to the country of Mauritania. The Islamic Republic of Mauritania is located in Northwest Africa and in 1981 became the last country in the world to make slavery illegal. Nonetheless, tens of thousands of people, mostly from the minority Haritian population, still live as bonded laborers, domestic servants, or child brides. Local rights groups estimate that up to 20% of the population is enslaved, with one in two Haritians forced to work on farms or in homes with no possibility of freedom, education, or pay. North Africa has a long history with slavery. Slavery is passed on through the mother to the child. And even though work has been made by activists to stop slavery in Mauritania, they too are tortured and detained by the government. African migrants tend to build their communities near long-established African-American neighborhoods. That makes them targets for racial profiling by overzealous police who disproportionately arrest them for minor offenses or unconstitutionally stop them for searches. Generally, migrants are worried of going out to socialize because there's a fear that if they are arrested, they will be detained for charges such as marijuana possession or use and racial profiling. Once they're arrested, due process is no longer a contributing factor. The Trump administration has already deported one man to Mauritania, and they could possibly deport three others as well. The lawmakers, including Senator Kamala Harris and Senator Bernie Sanders, want Nielsen and Pompeo to clarify U.S. policies and practices regarding deportations of Mauritanians to Congress within 60 days. There are real people who are at risk, such as a 37-year-old Issa Sow, who lives in Cincinnati with his wife, who is American, and two U.S.-born sons. He says, "Right now, I think they will kill us all," he told the Cincinnati Inquirer in a phone call from an ICE detention center in Louisiana last week on the same day as the White House human trafficking event. "I will be killed. That's all I can say. I will be tortured and killed. That is what they will do to us." Unfortunately, efforts by Sow's attorney have failed him, and he is now back in Mauritania.
We You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, October 17th, 2018. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Dan Raphael, Lucas Campbell, Ethan Rogers, and Rachel Hartley. Our engineer is David Kesters. The interim directors of Evening News and Public Affairs are Sam Bowman and Teresa Mitchell. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7 o'clock, it'll be Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's Native Voices from the Edge with Carrie and Amory. At 9, you'll hear Press Watch, Teresa Mitchell's weekly look at the news you're not supposed to know. At 9:30 on Fight the Empire, Per Fagerin talks to journalist Daniel Lazaro about his latest article that asks, is Saudi Arabia the Middle East's next failed state? At 10 o'clock, it'll be Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it'll be followed by Flashpoints with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 o'clock on Between the Covers, David Nyman speaks with author Dubravka Ugrešić about her new novel, Fox, and her revised and updated essay collection called American Fictionary. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you would like to become a member, you can go to kboo.fm right now and click on Donate. Once again, thank you for listening to the KBOO News. As Aaron mentioned, News from the BOO is off this week. Instead, we have a piece from Making Contact, an online media site that focuses on grassroots solutions to critical social issues. This is the first 15 minutes of a half-hour program called Your Home, Your Right, or My Business. It uses the housing crisis in Los Angeles as a lens for viewing solutions to housing shortages across the country. For the rest of the program and for past shows, go to radioproject.org.
This week on Making Contact.
Make some noise! Yeah! Make some noise if your rent has gone down. Yeah.
California's fight over rent control.
I want to share with you some of the real rent increases that I've heard straight from the mouths of tenants as I've been collecting signatures over the last few months. $100 every 3 months over the last 2 years. Seniors on a fixed income getting hit with a $350 a month increase. $1,000 all at once, plus no pets allowed any longer. That's an eviction notice.
The stage is set for a political battle between two polar worldviews. Is housing a human right, or is real estate an investment commodity? And where on that continuum is California's common ground? The Affordable Housing Act is a proposed state ballot initiative that, if approved, would once again allow local governments to create their own rent control laws. On this episode of Making Contact, we'll go to one of many smaller cities in California, where rents can double overnight. And later in the show, we'll go next door to the city of Los Angeles, where Making Contact contributor Carla Green looks at the city's policies affecting homeless encampments and their residents. But first we go to the city of Glendale, California, where a local tenants organization is working to qualify a city ballot measure that would cap rent increases at 4% a year.
Hello. Hello, I am a renter. I am part of the Glendale Tenants Union. I am living in constant anxiety. I'm on a month-to-month rental agreement, which can be raised as much as my landlord would like with only a few months' notice. The bulk of my paycheck goes towards my rent, and if it is unreasonably raised, I am going to need to leave Glendale, where I have built a life.
My name is Vanessa Sermeno, and I'm a preschool teacher full-time.
Vanessa had not been living in constant anxiety.
But yeah, it was always in the back of my mind, like it could happen. It just didn't happen. So I felt really lucky. I was like, okay, another year went by without a rent increase.
For 4 years, Vanessa and her two daughters lived comfortably in their Glendale apartment until this past February.
My daughter opened the mail to my oldest daughter, and she sent me a text while I was still at work. She took a picture of the letter and texted me. It's like, Mom, they're increasing our rent. And I was just, when I saw the letter, the picture, I was like, I just couldn't believe like how much they increased it by. And I just was like, oh my God.
Vanessa had been paying $1,100 a month. Her new rent would be $2,150, $1,050 more than what she had been paying.
At 60 days to either stay or give a notice to move.
The city of Glendale has what's called a just cause eviction law. It says that a landlord has to give a tenant 60 days notice and cite at least one of 12 reasons to legally evict them. The concern for renters like Vanessa is that currently there is no limit to the amount a tenant's rent can be raised.
Nairi Kachikian.
Council members, my name is Nairi Kachikian. I'm a member and volunteer with Glendale Tenants Union. I want to share with you some of the real rent increases that I've heard straight from the mouths of tenants as I've been collecting signatures over the last few months. $100 every 3 months over the last 2 years. Seniors on a fixed income getting hit with a $350 a month increase. $500 increased over 3 years. $1,000 all at once, plus no pets allowed any longer. That's an eviction notice. $1,200 all at once. That's an eviction notice.
The Glendale Tenants Union formed in 2017 after some of their members caught wind of steep rent increases. So they decided to get a petition together. It was pretty grassroots.
My name is Oganesh John Bagjian, and I'm retired.
John helped collect signatures in 2017 to put a rent stabilization measure on the local ballot.
And we laid out the ordinance in a couple of months. We didn't have the lawyers at that time. And we started as of March and ended up September, 6 months. We fought good fight, and we collected more than 11,000 votes. But the city didn't accept it because of some technicality.
The technicalities John's referring to were textual errors, and more seriously, alterations to the signature packets. A statement from the Glendale City Clerk's office described